This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, it is Thursday morning, which means the Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's. We are joined by three guests this morning who you know two of them very well. One of them has been a return offender, and he's back now for the second time. That's Khosi Chikane. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, and yourself?
Nice to see you. Canton Pile, Pumi Mashiko, and you, always invited to these discussions. Because sometimes they're hot, sometimes they're lemon and herb, sometimes they're burny, Mozambican, what do they call it? Mozambican chili?
Piri.
Yeah, that's it.
I think we may never invite Jose again because he doesn't know Prince.
I do know Prince, I just haven't heard his music.
That's outrageous.
It's crazy, but
I actually agree, I'm offended like Pumi is by this. Alright, morning everybody, and thank you for coming to be a part of this discussion. There's so much to talk about today. I mean, we can start off with something Pumi and Canton were about to get into just a minute ago and bring it back home afterwards. We always start with domestic affairs, but I didn't watch the debate. Apparently, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren kind of stood together against their moderates, the moderate attackers within the Dems. During the debate, and this was two nights ago, wasn't last night. How did it go? What did you surmise from it? Who wants to start on this?
Look, the bits I've been dipping in. I've been doing sort of parachuting in and out.
Let's just sketch the scenario for people. This debate situation in the Democratic Party is so complicated. There are about 24 candidates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they're doing different debates, and then they're doing different rounds of debates. And this one was Bernie, Elizabeth, Buttigieg, Beto, and some of the also-rans.
Yeah. Last night's one was Biden and Harris.
Biden, Harris, Kamala Harris, Booker.
Yeah, okay. Gabbard.
So that was, okay, so the previous one
on
Wednesday night was Elizabeth Warren and Bernie.
Yes.
So I haven't seen any of them because I don't care. And I think all of these candidates are dreadfully boring, and they're all trying to out-left each other without any indication of how policy might come into it.
Look, essentially what's happening is it's this entire sense of why these debates are actually totally counterproductive. Because it's the whole thing about, you know, the old South U.S. saying, never mud wrestle with a pig, because the pig likes it and you get dirty.
Right.
And really, last night, what we saw was a question of mud wrestling with pigs.
So what happened?
Essentially, anything that could even be considered to be slightly centrist was shot down by people on the extreme left. So when you have a situation where Joe Biden tries to give a sense that he espouses something in that broad category of what we might call family values. And, you know, let's be very clear. When I talk about family values, you know, I don't speak in terms of nuclear families, all right? Because it's perfectly possible for gay people to have family values. It's perfectly possible for single parents to have family values and all of that. But, you know, just the whole idea of, you know, kids being looked after and all of that kind of stuff. And then when you get attacked for trying to get a sense that, you know, it's important to support the idea of people having stable homes and, you know, being able to be brought up in an environment that teaches things that you and I would consider to be necessary. Things like respect and, you know, for our fellow human beings.
Human decency.
We've got the sons of two reverends in the studio, so we do have to watch that that they don't bring some family values down on us.
What happens.
Okay.
So the way I see it is it's the Democratic Party has, like, no idea how to take down Trump. And you're kind of seeing how it's playing out of the guys on the far left are thinking we have to go far left to tackle Trump because Trump is like a weird centrist far right person, depending on how he wakes up on that day. And yet the centrists are thinking to themselves, well, if we don't sort this out, we keep losing our states to Trump one by one.
It is so easy for the Democrats to beat Trump. All they have to do is A, not be crazy.
Yeah.
Just don't be crazy. Don't be insane.
Yeah.
And B, let him tweet himself into a fiery hot mess.
Yep.
Which he'll do because that's what Trump does. He can't help himself.
Yeah.
Instead, they go further and further left. They become more and more irrational. Like it all becomes about subjective lived experiences and who's blacker and who's more disadvantaged, who's going to give people more free college tuition, who's going to give people more free healthcare, more free stuff, who's going to give. And it becomes outrageous, right? I mean, like Bernie and Elizabeth are the worst in this crew.
They've gone like all the way
but,
in.
But Biden, I mean, Biden's kind of disappearing. His prominence in this election is not getting any better. And you see Pete Buttigieg, who's getting so much media attention, is sitting at like 4% in the polls. Mm. 4%? Is that the best he can do with all that media coverage?
I mean, it's crazy. In my mind, Democrats just need to win Michigan and Wisconsin. That's really all they need to do. Speaking far left just speaks to your base who are going to vote for you either way.
Yeah, they're not going to change.
Yeah, they're not going to change. The people you really want are the guys in the middle who are just like, hey, listen, during Obama's years, I lost my job. And during Obama's years, I lost my income. And during Obama's years, I didn't get what I thought I would get. I didn't get the promises that he gave. He gave other people what they wanted, but the people in the center got nothing. And Trump swooped in and gave them further promises and arguably has given a lot of people what they wanted. Really bad policy, but really good political backing from himself, I think. And that's the struggle that the Democrats have.
Well, I mean, do you agree with that, Pums?
We had this last week where I said to you, the left is in trouble. The left is completely in trouble, and that's what Trump plays so well into that space, where they're going to eat each other up. They're totally going to eat each other up. And that's what you see when you see the debate. That's what Canton's talking about, that they are mudslinging. Because they just have no new ideas. They're not talking to the people that are going to vote for them, whose minds they have to change. And you're just stuck in this like, so what?
What do you
and
say?
That's the, well,
you
the can, danger you, is you, that they then don't go and vote. The people who go out and vote just vote for Trump. The people that you're trying to convince, because there's nothing there, don't go out and vote, and that's how they lose.
If they had the election today, Trump wouldn't even have to wake up to check the results. He'd be president for another 4 years.
Well, I think I mentioned earlier that the person that I thought would have the best chance of actually going head-to-head with Trump was actually Biden. And essentially what's happened in the debates is that everyone else has ganged up on Biden and actually basically destroyed him. So one of the things that they've persuaded him to do right now is to walk back on any possibility of using fossil fuels in the future, which is such a pathetically stupid thing to do, because everyone who's involved in those industries who have now benefited directly from the fact that Trump has been supporting those is going to turn around and say, I'm not going to be supporting these guys. But essentially where the Democratic debate has gone to is it first starts off on the idea that we have to support the Green New Deal. The second thing that it ends up on is that we need to have reparations for black people. The third thing that it goes off on is that white males actually suck. The fourth thing that it goes off on is that Trump is dividing the country racially. I mean, what the fuck? Do you not see the contradiction between those things?
Yeah.
And if you want to summarize what the Democratic platform right now is, that is essentially the problem. And when the surveys have shown, and again, it's a very similar scenario to what we've got in our own country, where on a day-to-day basis, we actually get on fine with each other. And the truth is that for the average person in the U.S., race relations have never been better because of the fact that they've become sensitized to so many things.
This is what, I mean, look, we talked about Al Sharpton briefly a moment ago. These guys, they are traders in
sure,
race.
That's their currency. That's how they make a
living. So if they can't create a race conflict, they don't have a job. Like Al Sharpton goes in and finds companies where there's a race problem or where there's an incident, a single incident, which is by the way, no indication that there's a massive societal problem. And he then basically forces and strong arms these companies to give him money to make the problem go away.
That's an executive summary of a very profitable lifestyle for many people in that country and in our country as well.
So race hucksters.
Yes, but it crucially forgets the point that a conflict between a white person and a black person isn't necessarily about race. It just
might be one of them or both of them are assholes.
Like exactly.
They might just be assholes. They might just be bad people. I mean, I could have a fight in any given day with someone just because they're a rude, unpleasant person. And then after that fact, there might also be some kind of gender dynamic, race dynamic, or something else. But the primary purpose that I have for arguing with them is probably because they're just a disagreeable person.
Unless, like, you do it over and over again to that particular grouping.
No, sure. Then, there may be a pattern.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason a lot of us are interested in anything that happens in the political sphere is because it directly impacts our lives. The thing about the U.S. right now is they're doing so well. You know, the unemployment rate is at its lowest.
Right.
They're just everything else that would make you be interested in this thing is not there. And so without good ideas, even though, you know, when we look at it, the Democrats have over the past, you know, the economy grows under the Democrats, all of those things. But because they have nothing to add.
Well, does it?
Yes, it does.
Because, you know, here's the city thing that came up. Now, we've got Detroit, Baltimore, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., New York, all run by Democrats for at least the last 20, maybe 30, sometimes even 50 years. Yeah. Right. All of these cities are struggling. San Francisco has the highest homelessness rate in America.
Yep.
Right. We've got massive social ills in those areas. They're also the main locus of attraction for illegal immigrants, for people who are seeking employment. So that is not a policy problem. That's obviously a population dynamic. But all of these cities are run by Democrats, and all of them have among the most squalid living conditions for people under a certain income bracket. That is not the case, and you can go do a search now. It's interesting to find, if you do a search on the top 10 most unpleasant places to stay in America, that all of them are run by Democrats.
Mm.
Now, there has to be a reason for that, because there's obviously a policy dynamic in play if it's only Democrats, because some of these cities are very different geographically in terms of the kind of industry they support, the sort of societal norms and values that are in those societies. I think that there's something to be said for how Democrats just don't run things according to what they say one thing, they do another thing.
Yeah.
Their policies are counter to their own people.
I mean, yeah.
You know, you can accuse Trump of being a lot of things, and he is a lot of pretty awful things. I've said this a million times. Don't know why people seem to think that if you can find some reason to applaud someone, you can't also find some reason to criticize them. And that's true for our own country too. There are plenty of good policies and there are plenty of awful policies. Mm. And there are good people who sometimes make good policies, and there's also some good people who make terrible policies, right? Yep. This seems to be, though, for the Democrats, to go back to the election debates, a big area of cognitive dissonance. They don't seem to understand basic economics. They don't understand family values. These are things that conservatives inherently understand. And let's not forget, when we're talking about black populations in America, to go back to Al Sharpton for a second, black people in America are, by and large, conservative.
Yeah.
They hold conservative social ideas.
They live in that southern belt, the
majority. Religious beliefs, even political beliefs. And yet they vote Democrat, largely, right? I mean, there are exceptions to every rule. And if a Republican black person sticks their head up above the wall, people like Al Sharpton will want to shoot them down.
Well, there are two specific things that Trump has done that's actually going to get him lots of the African-American vote. The first thing, of course, is the question of employment.
Yeah.
Because unemployment levels among African-Americans is now at the lowest levels ever in history. The second thing that's going to win him significant brownie points is that Trump has been pushing very strongly for the rehabilitation of people who have been incarcerated.
Especially for petty crimes and drug
and a disproportionate number of those are African Americans. Because it's true, African Americans get locked up at a disproportionate level in the US.
Absolutely.
And because of the fact that Trump has been pushing very high visibility cases of African Americans that have been locked up, and he's actually found ways to get them employed.
See, but I might disagree with you slightly, and I'm not an expert on like American politics in any particular way. I think older African Americans indeed would hold those conservative views, but I think from a younger perspective, that's not necessarily the case. I think younger African Americans would definitely not vote for Trump.
But they don't vote. Full stop.
Yeah, they just.
But they will vote. They don't vote now, but they will vote. So often people will look at a young person and be like, "You don't vote now," and then forget that this is a potential vote for the next 6 elections.
What you're saying is not untrue at all.
Yeah,
but it's also true to say that most young people are left-leaning and young and liberal.
Yeah, And as they become 30,
as they get older, taxes. They as they get older and the reality starts to
set in. As they become parents.
Then suddenly they become conservatives.
Yeah.
And they start taking things a little more seriously, and all the ideology seems to slip out the back door. There's an interesting dynamic there as well in terms of age. In this country, too. Like, a lot of people are very left-leaning and liberal when they're in their 20s. I know I was. And then slowly, as the reality starts to set in, you move more and more to the conservative point of view.
Yeah. But the question is, how do you carry that vote, right? So in my mind, America and South Africa, for different reasons, have the similar problem. So in America, you have this huge group who's not voting. They will vote eventually. So how do you capture the imagination so when they choose to vote, they vote for your side? The one way not to get their vote is to bash them on their base. That will be a consistent, regardless if you're 50 years old or 20 years old, I won't vote for you if you bash me on my race. And America is going to have this population bulge where over 50% of the country is not going to be white in the next 20, 30 years. So that's the problem that the Republicans...
Well, 100% unless Trump builds the wall, of course.
They'll just... People fly in, guys. More people fly into the country than go over that border. But South Africa's facing that same problem. So I was having an argument with someone being like, young people, apathetic. They don't care about politics in South Africa. And I said, that's 6.4 million people who I think made the most politically mature decision in this country to say, this election process and democratic system that changes absolutely nothing in our lives, why would I participate in it? Why do the same thing over and over again expecting a different result? I am very curious to see what the 6.4 million people do in 2024 when they eventually do vote, because the 6.4 million is this fundamental born-free generation who are now saying, I know nothing about the past. I've heard the history books. I've learned what people have said. I'm not voting because someone sacrificed their lives. I'm voting because I'm unemployed. And who's going to employ me?
Chotsi Chikane is with us, as well as Kanton Pile and Pumi Mashiko. Chotsi, before you go, because I know you have to head out just in a moment or two, the unemployment figures came out this week. Oh. And among the unemployment figures were also a bunch of other stories about just real economic decline and complete lack of success in this current regime. Now, how are we feeling about that for the opportunities that might present themselves to young people? How are we feeling about the fact that we've got this cognitive dissonance in our own polity at the moment about what the economic policies should be, what things like private property amount to?
Yep.
The Land Commission has come out with their report this week. Do you have any comments on those?
Yeah, our politicians have all lost their minds as usual. It's crazy how since the elections, we haven't had one economic debate in the country. No political party has come out and said, here's my plan to get rid of unemployment. Not even the ruling party knows what they're doing to get rid of unemployment in the country. But everything is focused on, let's bash each other around our democratic institutions, which is an important thing, right? The fight for our institutions is a hugely important thing. But we are not single-track-minded individuals, and a government can't be that. You can't have the president saying 3 weeks ago, saying, you know what, we're going to create 200,000 jobs every year. Hmm. And then a couple of weeks later coming out and saying, oh, this fourth industrial revolution is going to cause us to lose jobs. That's crazy. I want you to give me a consistent line of thought to essentially say, here's my policy idea. These are the type of jobs you're going to create. These are the industries that are going to be booming. And this is the plan. We have no plan at all. And when the unemployment results come out, it's indicative of not knowing what a plan is. But it makes it even worse because it creates that hopelessness. If the 29% came out, but we knew there was a plan to tackle it, it'd be one of those things of, cool, we'll see how we are 6 months from now. Because we have no plan, it just seems like we're heading deeper and deeper into this black hole. And we don't know what to do about it.
Well, Pumi said the other day, and I know you want to jump in here, but Cyril actually had the temerity to say to people, get ready, you're going to lose some jobs.
Yep.
You're going to take some pay.
Yep.
So he's gone from, I promise to create X number of jobs, to get ready for a whole lot of pain and suffering.
I think that the critical thing, and Jose, you know, and I suppose because for you as a young person, this is something that's completely top of mind because it's yourself and your peers that are about this in the 2024. Mm. Nobody else has a plan. So even as you go into the election, it's not like the DA is saying, this is my plan and this is how I'm going to tackle this. So it then says, are young people going to vote for the DA? ATM?
Oh, I forgot about them.
IFP?
But I don't think
EFF.
I'm checking Bitcoin prices as we speak.
Well, you know, because that's the thing, and like in America, where young people just don't go and vote, and this is the fundamental flaw of democracy, is it's about the people who vote. So yeah, the people who go and vote are going to make a decision on who that government of the day is.
Based
and
on what on what Khosi says, that I need to ask everybody here, do we actually believe that people are sufficiently informed about how economics works?
No.
For them to be able to make any kind of – people don't seem to understand these fundamentals. And I'm not talking about that you have to have a degree in economics, but that for you and I to transact on a voluntary basis – and with supply and demand being the only factors at play, is the most honest kind of relationship we can have. And it seems to me that government, imagine that they're still in 1960 or 70-something, that they can control all of these various levers, that they can make society into what they want it to be, they can transfer this to here and it'll be so. And it doesn't work like that anymore.
Yeah, I think South Africans... And Shane, yeah, you know what, I'll bash all South Africans. I think it's even more basic than whether you understand supply and demand. One of the basic ones that I feel like South Africans are missing is don't spend money you don't have.
Mm.
There's this belief that South Africans can just print money to solve all our social ills. I am a big proponent on an American style of small government slash public service in half. This is the controversial one. Slash the social security net that we've created. Of 16 million people relying on social grants in the country. Because South Africa, if Eskom fails, and I feel like people forget about this, if Eskom fails for whatever reason,
when Eskom fails.
Or when it fails, it's not just Eskom. It is because all the debt is tied together with all the SOEs. If Eskom fails, all the SOEs fail because all the banks are allowed to then recall all their debts from any state-owned enterprise at reasonable amounts, right? It means at that point, we go straight to the IMF. Because we do not have enough money. You can't have our tax base is like 4 million
people.
Maybe
that's a good idea because maybe the IMF would run our economy better than we do.
It would be interesting.
That's why the debate on the other show was so interesting for me, right? But here's the thing. Gareth, earlier, we, you know, kind of feeling very bad about the fact that I think that it's a very basic thing in terms of as a politician that you're talking to, understand this, that when you are a politician or when you are a country, like we are talking about, do South Africans understand, is that you have to aggregate by the number of South Africans the level of understanding and intelligence and bring it down to the lowest common denominator.
No, we do that very well.
So that
our politicians,
Pumi especially, does that very well because she thinks
because
that
understand
black
that
people are too stupid to actually understand that Mashaba is not saying kill all black
That's
people.
Absolute bullshit. That's not what I said. But here's the thing: when you come down to the lowest common denominator,
that's
this is why slogans work so well.
But
this is why he's
just saying now we need to start educating people on the basics of like saving your money rather than spending it. We haven't had a single economic debate since the elections. He rightly points out.
So even as we wanna say, South Africans should understand this.
But for me, but there's
they don't.
So much
but
you rhetoric.
See, they don't. In fact, even middle class South Africans don't understand that. That's why we've got such a highly indebted middle class. That's why credit cards and all. Because even at middle class level, middle management, even upper middle management, they don't understand it. And now when you must bring it down to the economic understanding of an entire nation, and we know where our nation's literacy rate is at. We know all of those things. Is when you bring it down to that lowest common denominator, no one is doing that. It serves politicians to not educate people like that.
You're not hearing me. They only give this rhetoric in lowest common denominator talk. They're all promising the same stuff they were promising 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Politicians are not talking up to anyone. I don't think that's happening at all. They are patronizing to an extreme when they talk to, especially young people. Do you remember how the president addressed young people about these fees must fall protests?
Mm.
He treated them like idiots.
Yeah.
And if the university graduates, and look, a lot of them were idiots, but if university graduates are spoken to like that, that's the only toolbox the politicians in this country have.
Yeah. young people right now have this one concern. The government will come back, and all political parties one way or another will say the lowest common denominator is give an RDP house. An RDP is a proxy for many things of government, yep, give you something so that you can survive, whether it's social grants, RDP houses, water, electricity. Give me something. Young people now are saying, I just want a job so I don't need your help, so I can survive by myself. I don't want to live on a social grant. I don't need your
house.
Let
me ask you then. Yeah. Do government want that? Because government want you to be their serf.
Exactly. So government has gotten themselves into a trap. Of the ANC in particular, right? You can't create the social grant network and then get rid of it, because it becomes the biggest political way of getting votes. Right, you are directly influencing someone's life month in, month out. Mm-hmm. You're touching
their
lives. Right? To get rid of them and make them independent, economically independent, also makes them politically independent. And that's not something a political party would want. But also, at the same time, as government, you can't have that on your income and expenditure sheet.
All that ends up happening is you end up with costs going up and income going down.
Yeah. We don't have a single party right now. And the DA has got flip-flopped on this. Actually, I don't think they flip-flopped. We don't have a single party in this country anymore that is advocating for a smaller government. We don't have a single party that's advocating to say we want to get people off social grants. Right? Besides the capitalist party, but that's another. The purple cows is another story in of itself. But no one is advocating that at a high level. The parties that matter, no one is seeing the grander picture of, to grow this economy, you need to get people off social grants. Not to take the social grant and leave them in destitution, but to get their livelihood so they don't need it anymore.
Yeah, but I don't think we even understand productivity. Like, some people think that just because they exist, they deserve. I mean, that's the weirdest thing.
That is such a brilliant line. I might steal that from you.
Yeah, I mean, productivity. Like, what are you adding?
Tweet that later.
And politicians are the most guilty of this, because they add no value to the system. They only take value away.
Mm.
They take what other people have made, and they confiscate their labor in order to pay out social grants to people who are beholden to them. So it's a perverse system. Let me ask you a practical question, all of you, while we've still got you here, Jose. So Pretoria at the moment, Tswane, they've got this massive municipal strike going on. All the municipal workers want an 18% increase, 1.8. Regardless, they haven't done their jobs better. The government isn't necessarily working like a charm in Pretoria. It's certainly working better than it did under the ANC.
Mm.
But there's no largesse. There suddenly isn't a big pot of money that needs to be distributed out to all the workers in the municipality. It's still a mess. Pretoria always has been. The CBD in particular is very unattractive. So they're trashing the town in order to get their 18%. They're not willing to negotiate. They don't care about macroeconomics. They want 18%. Now, how do you deal with this? What is the only way to deal, or what are the options of the ways to deal with people in the municipality who are protesting right now, ruining the city? What would you do?
I would start off with the fact that we've got video footage of just about every single person that was involved in this. So I'd start off with the people who stole the buses and parked them to blockade roads. So let's be very clear, they stole the buses. And there's a very clear paper trail in terms of those people. The first thing you do is to put every single one of them in jail for theft. The second thing is that everyone who was seen on the streets actually trashing the streets, again, you've got video footage, you go after them, and you arrest them and lock up all of them for vandalism. And once you've actually done that, treated them like the criminals that they actually are, everyone else will very quickly fall into line. But that actually requires something that is fundamentally missing in our country, and that is the will to govern. We do not have the will to govern. Nobody actually goes after these perpetrators, and that's why they keep doing it, and that's why they will keep getting away with it.
See, I don't think that solves. It's a solution.
Exactly, case in point.
It's a solution, right? But then if I follow your logic, then we wouldn't have any service delivery protests ever. Because it's not like people always get away. People do get arrested. But the culture of protest is grown to the point of my concern of getting arrested and my concern of what I need, right? I can get arrested because I need to get what I need for one
person.
But
the culture of getting arrested doesn't exist. Nobody gets arrested.
People
in
do get arrested. People get arrested all the time for protests.
The only person who got arrested for protests was this guy who got arrested in Fees Must Fall, who was locked up in
Durban. But that question's like it's an appendage to the core issue. The core issue for how I would solve it is they shouldn't be working in that job in the first place. That is a low income level job.
Right.
It is, I am fighting. It's not like they're living largesse. They're fighting for scraps. The 18% is fighting for an 18% increase on a scrap wage that you have. The real key is they shouldn't be in that job in the first place. They should be in a higher paying job of some sort. And that should be the goal. And I feel like trade unions fundamentally fail on this. Trade unions allow the idea that it is fine to have a scrap wage and it's fine to have a useless job or to have a menial job. Trade unions should actively be saying, I want you to move up the ladder of this company, or I want to upskill your training so that you can leave this industry. But that works against trade unions' mindsets. In my mind, you can't have the majority of people in the country living on low income levels and then bash them for complaining about low income levels.
So far, you have advocated for the dissolution of government and trade unions. You're working hard this morning. So I thought Canton was the most. This is all right. So Pumi, what would you do?
Why was that about the lowest common denominator? Yeah, because that's what you're seeing. Because that's what you're seeing when you're seeing this level of protest. Then we often say we have to learn how to get angry better, right? So how do you get angry better? You actually have to. Unfortunately, I have to agree with Canton. Is you have to put in place a thing that incentivizes you not to be angry in this manner. That's just what it is. But political will, you know. The political will of doing these things, and we see it everywhere. I mean, even in, you know, so Eskom has all of these problems, and what did Phakamani want to do? Phakamani wants to cut the wage bill. The first thing that happens is
unions.
Yeah.
The politicians step in to say, don't do that. The man is tasked with changing a situation that is fundamentally bad.
With both hands tied behind his back.
Right?
Yeah.
So they've brought in Jabu Mabuza there, right?
Yeah.
Does this, is he the only card in their deck anymore?
It's a very bad card as well.
But Jesus.
But there's so many things wrong with that.
They've resuscitated this poor man's career a billion times because he seems to be the only one who the majority of ANC MPs or NEC members will trust to handle a situation. Whether he does it well or not is besides the point. But he's the only one who can gather enough consensus to get a position.
Well, that's an interim position. And what generally happens in a company where you suddenly have the abrupt removal of a chief executive. In this case, it wasn't abrupt because resignation was tendered, what, 3 months ago?
In May!
Yes.
And they haven't been able to find a replacement.
However,
would you want that job?
Understand at the same time that there's the second process that's going on, which is the appointment of the chief restructuring officer, which again is a process that's taking place under the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. But which, by the way, we should get Kaya Sitole and again to talk about that particular thing.
His thread yesterday was incredible. Did you see it?
Yes. Yeah.
His thread yesterday was incredible.
But the crucial thing to remember is that the appointment of an executive chairman to run a company in the absence of a chief executive is fairly standard practice for corporates.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to recognize that this is an interim measure. He's not there to hold the job down in the duration. But in the absence of finding a suitable candidate that, and remember the candidate has to be shaped by what comes out of the restructuring process.
Right.
Look, this, Eskom is such a basket case right now that just simply saying we need to take someone and plonk them in here instead of saying what are the priorities that are needed in terms of the restructuring. Fundamentally, what might be needed is a breakup of this organization into those separate entities, you know, power generation, power transmission, all of those things. Mm-hmm. In which case, the criteria that you would have for appointment of CEO would become multiple CEOs for the individual entities. So I'm not seeing this particular thing as something that we need to stress about.
Okay.
But I think the things that you do have to stress about is, Gareth Cliff, your fave, Tito Mboweni, right? Makes a big song and dance a couple of months ago.
Listen, please, meals.
Not my fave. I'm trying to see the silver lining on the cabinet's ugly black cloud.
But so he makes a big song and dance about restructuring of SOEs.
Yeah.
And the fact that restructuring is paramount to them getting any kind of assistance in terms of bailouts and stuff,
yeah.
Right? And then without... 2 days ago, I think they announced the CRO for Eskom, right? Mm. But Eskom had their bailout approved already before this guy was in place. Their bailout was approved. No other restructuring officers have been named, and yet they're currently in the budget votes for all of this. So it's all too up in the air, and the political will to lead, to change. And I think we have to talk about the fact that our president, guys, is AWOL.
Yeah, nobody our has president seen or heard is AWOL. From him.
He's not even sleeping at the wheel. He's not there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy because, and on that issue, I mean, he came out really firm at the beginning of the year. We are going to disband ESCOM into these four different units.
Do you think
units.
He's having a breakdown?
I think he's stuck fighting. I think he's realizing that he underestimated the internal politics of the ANC. ACE has made some really good moves, long-term moves. The idea that you don't have control over parliament because all your parliamentary chairs weren't selected by you. ACE has consolidated all the power back in Luthuli House. And the beginning of the year, the real fight was, where's the power? Union buildings or Luthuli House? I think Luthuli House has fundamentally been able to say, we don't have power, but we have a critical voice of some sort. And we will use that voice for like useless things. Talk about nationalization of Reserve Bank. They don't internally believe in that, but it disrupts the power in the union buildings.
And it gets the chattering people chattering. Yeah.
And now the discussion of next year NGC has finally come out.
Yeah.
And that
so
shows you.
Do you think Cyril's already lost?
No. Because Cyril just needs to be a bully. At some point, you just need to be like, I don't want to have a second term as president of the ANC or of this country. And because of that, I am going to be a bully on these issues because I have the executive authority to do it. And someone, he's acting like someone who wants a second term in office at the beginning of his first term. And I think that's worrying.
All right. It's Women's Month. Today's the 1st of August. There's going to be a lot of lip service paid to women this month. What are you most excited about not hearing, Pumi? I mean, because this is an issue. It always comes up. People, you've got all these male politicians and even the ANC Women's League and, you know, institutions like that that come out and say all these patronizing things, just like lowest common denominator stuff that you were talking about earlier about women. What nonsense are they going to say this year that's going to make any difference at all?
And remember that you speak for all women at this point.
Yeah, oh, do I?
Yeah, because you're the only one in
okay,
the room.
In that case, then I'm going to use my favorite Betty White quote of all times. Right?
Which is,
I don't know why everybody wants to have balls. You know, we often talk about growing a pair of balls because balls are so soft and squishy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like I really wish.
If you really want to compliment someone to finish the quote.
I really wish.
You should have a
you
vagina.
You should grow a vagina.
There we go.
Like I think our executives, our politicians, they should like grow something that can take a pounding.
Well, that links nicely to what, you know, to what Khosi was saying about Cyril. He's got to grow a vagina or a pair of balls.
Yeah. And be willing to take the pounding, you know, be willing to be battered and withstand it. Actually, be willing to withstand it because you see it everywhere. I mean, I think we were speaking earlier about politicians.
I
not
really didn't think we'd have the line taking a pounding straight after a vagina.
No, I was not touching that line.
In the context of Women's Month.
What a start to Women's Month. Could you ask for more? This is unbelievable. Oh, my God.
No, because, you know, politicians, unfortunately, break everything in there. And what are we seeing? Look at what another one of our favorite politicians has done to the shareholder value of Old Mutual.
Mm.
Right?
Right.
Down 5.5%.
So
because there
fight.
Is a fight yeah. that really shouldn't be happening. This fight should not be playing out in the public space. And now that, you know, Peter Moyo has been somewhat vindicated in part one of a two-part battle, instead of taking the advice of going back inside, closing the doors and fixing their mess, we have a politician that's going to die on the hill for, you know, he's going to die on the hill for what it is that he wants. He's destroying shareholder value.
There was an interesting appointment this week, and I'd like to have your opinions on Ruhul Khoza in the PIC.
Oh, the avocado.
I'm behind Ruhul Khoza.
Avocado King.
You say avocado king. Are you being pejorative?
No, Shane, I think what he's doing with his life.
I think, yeah, he's an avocado king like that.
Sure.
That's his life.
Avos are hugely profitable. Yeah, ask any millennial.
Yeah, that's right.
He's a farmer.
Man, I'm going to go to Woolworths after this and get my avos because I ran out this weekend. I think it was a good appointment.
Okay.
I think the PIC is just like an all-round mess of messes. And I like the idea of getting someone who's a lot more detach from politics, right? So you won't be, hopefully, and we've been burnt a few times.
Ruhul Khoza has always said things that ran contrary to the the dogma of the political party.
He got seriously smacked down during the Zuma era.
Yeah.
Correct. So maybe he doesn't care anymore, which is precisely what you need.
It's that's like exactly the person.
A guy need. In charge of all that money who knows that he's actually the custodian of people's retirement.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. And so far, the PIC has been seen as a cash register for ANC cadres to deploy money left, right, and center into projects that we know are going to fail. Am I right?
I'm with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, do we like Rule Khoza, Pumi?
We love Rule Khoza.
Okay. I mean,
not least of all because we love avocados.
So, I give every new appointment now, I've gotten to a point where I say, I'm giving you like 6 months before I start bashing you. Like 6 months of figuring out how this institution runs, figuring out who the role players are, and then give us your plan. Like, tell us what you're going to do next.
Can we
reinvigorate the country?
Since you're still here, can we talk about your article that you wrote?
Yeah, sure.
So you said, with the coming of age of South Africa's free, born into bondage generation, and you've put a, you know, you've created this, this nice parallel between the two. We need to understand what it means to defend South Africa's institutions and the dangers of deferring this responsibility to those who seek to defend them under the guise of social providence, whether in fact the defense appears eerily particularistic. Now, what do you mean by that? Which institutions, which democratic institutions are you most worried about? And who is attacking them?
Yeah, so for me, the all Chapter 9 institutions, at a meta level, I'll get down to the particular people I'm criticizing. At a meta level, all Chapter 9 institutions are being systematically defunded in one way or another. That, for me, is state capture. That is, how do I weaken the democratic institutions of the country by not giving them money so that it makes it easier for me to steal? So even if you have a really good person in the office, their job is still hamstrung, right? So there's that. The particular individuals is EFF and ANC and Pravin Gordhan in certain respects. All of them around the public protector.
Mm-hmm.
The institution of the public protector should be defended at all costs, even against the public protector itself. But when you start using that fight and forget that the institution is what I'm fighting for and defending the individual or attacking the individual in the office, it belies the truth, right? Cyril Ramaphosa's campaign, and I feel like I'm bashing Cyril a lot today, but Cyril Ramaphosa's campaign is not a completely clean campaign and should be investigated. You can't have, and in her report, you can't have someone get 200 million rand, three people get 200 million rand donated. There's no minutes of how that money gets used. There's no record of where that money went to.
Mm-hmm.
But we just implicitly trust them. These same three individuals are now the advisors to the president. You have to ask the question. The EFF, on the other hand, last year were bashing Busim Khobane.
Yeah.
Last year were saying we have to protect her, we have to get her out of the office. This year, because it suits her narrative, because she's investigating things that down the line the EFF is going to have to face. SARS is eventually going to get Julius Malema at some point. And they know that. They understand that Pravin Gordhan is one of the biggest political inhibitors to their success in this country of mm-hmm. owning the narrative of state capture. So I use my defense of the public protector to fight my political battles. And I am fine with that. As long as we acknowledge that the way we defend our institutions informs the way we rebuild them going forward. If we want to defend our institutions by intimidating Pravin Gordhan, then the type of institutions we will be building in the future by those same people will use intimidation tactics. Pravin Gordhan can't hide behind the public protector and say, oh, I'm going to bash the incompetence of the public protector, and in the same breath have say, oh, I respect the office of the public protector. You don't have to do that. You can simply say, if I know this person is mediocre, and I think everyone's on the same page, she is... We are giving her rope. She is going to go down the hill
right,
herself.
She'll sink herself.
Right?
Yeah. And then we'll have a new public protector.
And
you'll
have a new one.
The institution mustn't be damaged.
Exactly
critically,
that.
Saying.
And I think Cyril Ramaphosa, and this is his good thing of, I am not going to bash you as an individual. I'm just saying I'm following my legal processes.
Right.
Pravin Gordhan went off and bashed that individual. And Pravin Gordhan has a habit of doing that. He's a wily old politician since the 1980s. This has been his tactic, right? But it's a tactic that's worked for him. My question is, as a generation, we can't be beholden to like the EFF or individuals protecting our institutions. And we have to figure out as a nation how we do that ourselves.
All right. I don't think anyone here disagrees. No? Am I assuming too much? Don't want to put words in your
I don't think we have enough time to go into this particular debate right
just
now.
Bring
I mean,
me back another
But you know, for example, one of the things that I agreed with Mogoeng on was the idea of holding her personally accountable for the legal fees,
yes,
was actually overshooting the mark, because I do believe that it has a chilling effect on the actual office of the public protector without actually establishing a precedent in terms of law at the point at which one is actually able to hold those officials personally accountable.
I said, just don't lie and then you won't pay the cost. She lied.
Yes. But again, the question of whether that then becomes a standard that gets applied to every single official.
Yeah. Don't lie as the public protector.
Yes. But it starts off with ministers.
But it creates, yeah.
Yeah. And it then extends to every single public office in the country. And what I'm trying to say is that I don't have any problem with the question of personal accountability, but it has to be constrained by law so that you actually have a clear definition of when this can be applied. I don't want a situation where there is reluctance on the part of people in these institutions to actually go after people who have the financial wherewithal to be able to defend themselves, yeah, you know, aka big corporates.
So
because of the fact that there might be a situation where they get accused of lying and they have to pay out of their own pocket. So don't get me wrong. It's not the question of accountability. I'm all for the accountability, but we need to actually understand the importance of putting in place this legal framework that's going to constrain exactly how these things get applied.
You see, this
and I think singling out the public protector in this particular case was a problem for me.
So this is why I don't like the minority judgments at times. Like, they follow a very good course of logic. Mukwege's minority judgment is really good. I just think the majority one was better. They touch on this. The majority judgment talks about, to say, Batabile was the last public official who had to account on her personal basis. And they use that as the precedent. And they say, we're going to compare this to what is happening now. The lies, the confusion, the obfuscation.
Obfuscation.
Yes. Obfuscation.
Don't worry, it's a horrible word.
Busiziro Mokobane is such an extreme level to come out and say, in one aspect, oh, I forgot to tell the High Court about this meeting. My bad. A public protector does not get a my bad type situation. And when the Constitutional Court is asking her, please account for the situation, and she says, well, I have to go find my notes. Oh, sorry, I took notes for every other meeting except the two important meetings with the president and the security services. It's maddening. And
you and I have no disagreement on this point at all. What I'm simply trying to say is that that process should not come in the form of a attack on a single specific case. Really, that is a situation where that effectively becomes legislating from the bench. And that's a difficulty that I have.
I think the majority judgment dealt with that. And that's why I really think the majority really paid a lot of focus on making sure that we don't set that precedent. And one of the lines,
I admire that you read both the minority and majority.
Yeah. Well,
isn't that what everybody in this country is doing?
Should.
Every night we're reading a different judgment.
No, I wish we were. I think what we
most people don't care
is we decide which individual we're backing. And this is more to your point, Jose. We go, well, I'm on the EFF side against Praveen, or I'm on Praveen's side, or I'm on Cyril's side against Busi. We choose a person, and this is how all of South African politics
works.
It's like
1912,
works. It's 18. Headman stuff.
Yeah.
It's like strongman stuff. So we choose our person.
Yes, Mashal versus xenophobe. I mean.
And we back them to the nth degree. That's all we do.
Yeah.
It's like children choose a soccer team. And then whether we win or lose the match, we support our soccer team.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that's what's happened. All right, guys and girls, we've had enough time for today. I'm sure that there are lots of other questions and issues that can come up, but we'll have to save them for the next time. Jose, thanks for your time. I know you were only going to stay with us for 20 minutes. You obviously were enjoying yourself.
Yeah, I was.
Good. Pumi Mashiko, thank you. Canton Pele, thank you. And thank you to Nando's, who bring you the Birthing Platform every single week on a Thursday, just in case you need to hear some good debating. And Pums, to our debate from earlier, someone said they absolutely loved that. What a stimulating, interesting discussion between two people. I'm salivating in traffic. This is before we started the Birthing Platform. So here's to more of me and Pumi arguing as well. I love it. All right. Thank you very, very much. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9 o'clock. Have an excellent day in the company of cliffcentral.com. And keep it on for more entertainment, information, empowerment, and inspiration.
This is cliffcentral.com.